We have come from all the nations of the earth to say to the people of Israel, we are your friends, we are with you, and we believe that you are called by God to possess this land, to make this your eternal unified capital, and that God Almighty is watching over you, and our prayers are with you on this day.
That was the Reverend Pat Robertson speaking at a recent pilgrimage of American evangelicals to Israel. Greetings and welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're going to talk about American evangelical support for Israel during this last hour of the program today. Feel free to join us with questions or comments. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Timothy Weber is our guest. He's president of Memphis Theological Seminary. He's authored a new book called On the Road to Armageddon, How Evangelicals Became Israel's Best Friend. Dr. Weber, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
Why is it axiomatic today among American evangelicals, most of them, that if you're a good Christian, you support Israel?
Well, first of all, I don't think that most evangelicals would necessarily say that, although I wouldn't be surprised. I think that at least a third of them, maybe more, would answer that question by saying, because without Israel being in the land, its own nation, well-established and protected, that Jesus Christ isn't coming back a second time. And so they base their politics on a particular view of Bible prophecy.
What is that particular view? You spend the better part of your book describing not only the history of, but also the implications and the results of premillennial dispensationalism. Describe this framework for reading Bible prophecy to us.
Yes, dispensationalism is one type of premillennialism that originated in Great Britain in the 1830s and which came to this country after our Civil War in the 1870s. Its originator was a man named John Nelson Darby, and he came up with some rather novel approaches to Bible prophecy. He used a lot of old ideas and then developed some new ones and began to preach that doctrine not only in the Plymouth Brethren in Great Britain, but in the United States among different evangelical groups. Dispensationalism is a way of understanding the whole Bible as a series of dispensations or eras in which God deals with humanity in different ways through this progressive revelation. The end of the process is a millennial kingdom that is brought into being by Jesus' return at the second coming.
Is it safe to say that dispensationalism as a way of reading the Bible is also now in its current modern form a way of reading the headlines?
I think that's a very good way of putting it. Dispensationalism, from its very beginning, has really gained credibility as it's been able to demonstrate how its reading of the times corresponds to what's actually going on out there. And can be seen in the daily newspaper. You're right.
Now, let's talk about that correspondence briefly before we get into these things in more detail. One might get the impression, if they weren't really paying attention to the entire scope of dispensational writings, that there has been kind of this consistent view that the things that we're talking about today as being the fulfillment of biblical prophecy, some might even say, I'm thinking about Tim LaHaye saying that the war in Iraq was a prelude to Armageddon. That's been part of their teaching all along. Has there been a selective reading of Bible prophecy vis-a-vis the headlines of the day over the course of dispensationalism's history?
Well, I think so. I spend part of the book showing how, from time to time, the dispensational reading of current history has just not worked out. There have been some major adjustments. History has a way of taking unexpected turns. And when that happens, either dispensationalists go into denial, they tweak it some more, or they make adjustments in their system. And probably the biggest case in point would be the decline of the Soviet Empire by 1990. Since the turn of the century, dispensationalists have been adamant that one of the main players just before the return of Jesus Christ would be Kings of the North, which they defined as the Soviet Union and its Eastern European satellites. But when the Soviet Empire fell apart, this left kind of a hole in the interpretive scheme. And there's been a lot of changing of the subject since 1990.
There are still a few, Dr. Weber, who insist that, at least in the form of the Russian state, that all those prophecies and their reading, their previous readings, are still in force.
That's right. And you know, you find a different way of dealing with the demise of the Soviet Union within dispensationalist circles. Some continue to say that, well, it wasn't the Soviet Union, but it's got to be Russia. Others are, like Pat Robertson, we heard his voice a few minutes ago. He doesn't speak much more about Russia or the Soviet Union. He talks about the New World Order, which has him pretty frightened. So, you know, it all depends on which teacher you're listening to, but there's, at a time of a kind of shift in world events, like we saw with the demise of the Soviet Union, it takes dispensationalists a while to get a common voice again with their interpretations.
Dwight Pentecost wrote what probably most old-style dispensationalists is considered the textbook on the thing.
Things to Come.
Things to Come.
Yes.
He wrote there, and I've always found this quite interesting, he wrote there that the problem with people who are not dispensationalists, and I paraphrase, is that they take God's redemptive plan in Jesus Christ, and they make that a central feature of the Bible rather than a secondary or tertiary feature of the Bible, and he argues that Israel ought to be the central feature rather than God's redemptive work in Jesus Christ.
Yeah, I bet he's sorry he said that, but it is true that dispensationalism from the beginning has made a distinction between the two peoples of God, the earthly people of God, Israel, and the heavenly people of God, the church. And in the pristine dispensational system, now some modern dispensationalists have made some adjustments here because it ends up sounding so bad and so out of sync with historic Christian teaching that they felt compelled to do so. But in its pristine form, dispensationalists have argued that Jesus Christ came the first time, he offered the kingdom to Israel, Israel turned it down, and therefore God ceased to deal with Israel, which was the main show, and then came up with a second people as a kind of plan B, and this was the church, and continues to work with the church as a new people of God until the church is full in the mind of God, and then God raptures the church and reconnects with Israel to fulfill all the prophecies to Israel. You know, when Pentecost puts it that way, that is really kind of right down the middle as far as historic dispensationalism has taught, that the church does not have any prophecies of its own in the Bible. All the prophecies that have to do with earthly events belong to the Jews and not to the church. The church is an afterthought of God.
So technically speaking, if a thoroughgoing classical dispensationalist reads the Bible, and he's reading Old Testament Bible prophecy, he needs to conclude first and foremost that as a Gentile Christian, none of this applies to him.
That's true. Yeah, that's right. And Darby was very plain. He said, to rightly divide the word of truth, what you need to do is to keep the two peoples and the two plans of God completely separate. And anytime you come to a prophecy that has to do with earthly events, then you must conclude that it applies to the earthly people of God, Israel.
Does this also mean, you mentioned a plan B,
mm-hmm.
and that the church is a plan B. Does this also mean that if the dispensationalist is consistent, the cross has to be really a plan B? A plan B, first Jesus was intended to establish an earthly kingdom in Israel, but when that failed because of Israel's rejection, he had to go to the cross.
Well, you know, here is where dispensationalists themselves get rather fuzzy, because a dispensationalist will look at the prophecy of Daniel, for example, and talk about this anointed one coming and being cut off, you know, the 70 weeks of Daniel, which really gets complicated. And But when they exegete those passages, they will say, well, you know, the cross, the cutting off of Messiah was certainly part of God's plan. This was at the center of God's plan. So, you know, when you try to put it all together, they end up with a very complex system that is hard to justify in all of its parts, in my view at least.
Let's talk about dispensationalism before the founding of the modern state of Israel.
Yes.
And dispensationalism after the founding of the modern state of Israel.
Yes. Well, I think there's a world of difference between the two. The metaphor I use in the book is that before the founding of the modern state of Israel, dispensationalists were very content to be history's great spectators and explainers. It's as though they were sitting up high up in the stands on history's 50-yard line, and they were explaining to everybody else how the game down on the field was going to be played. Now, because they believed in the pre-tribulation rapture of the church, they thought that they would be taken out of the earth before all the events of the last days would begin. But they did think that the players would be assembled on the field and that they would be lining up in ways that certainly pointed toward the fulfillment of all those prophecies. But they stayed up in the stands. They never thought it was their job to go down there and line people up on the field or to support the program in any way. This was all in God's hands. But after Israel became a nation, dispensationalists became more and more concerned that Israel be protected. After all, this was the last phase of the program. And as Israel was attacked by neighbors, found itself despised in the world, and its own security often threatened, dispensationalists felt that as believers in God, they needed to support this last great prophetic fulfillment that God was bringing about in the world. So, again, the metaphor, after 1970, certainly after 1980, they started piling out of the stands onto the field and began to rearrange the players and support certain teams over other teams in order to make the prophecies work out right. And so they had a much more activistic and blatantly political agenda after the founding of the State of Israel, certainly after the Six-Day War in 1967.
I'm a little confused, though, because if this is, in fact, the playing out of biblical prophecy and the dispensationalist believes that it can't happen a different way than it is happening,
yes.
Why do they feel the need to get involved?
Well, that is a very good question, and this is a question I've been posing as an historian for a long time. One of the great turnarounds you can see in the career of Hal Lindsey. Hal Lindsey wrote The Late Great Planet Earth in 1970, which became the best-selling book of any type in the 1970s. Through Hal Lindsey's work, therefore, dispensationalism kind of spread out into the popular culture and became available to all kinds of people who had never even heard of it before. If you read Late Great Planet Earth, you see that it is first, last, and always an evangelistic exercise. He is using the predictions of the last days in order to get people to make commitments to Christ. And he weaves that evangelistic thread throughout his entire book. 10 years later, in 1980, he writes a book called Countdown to Armageddon. And he argues that we're in the last generation, and that the events that he predicted in 1970 were coming to pass. But then he takes a very unexpected turn. He argues, he said in the first book that America was doomed, like other nations in the world. It would fall under the curse of God, that it would be destroyed toward the end. It would be judged, like all nations will be judged at the time of Antichrist and so on. But the implication there in 1970 was there's nothing we can do about it. America is on the downward slide. But in 1980, he says, things are coming to pass just as I predicted, but if American Christians will do their duty and get politically involved, we can keep America from sliding down that slope until after the rapture.
Interesting.
And so all of a sudden, politics becomes extremely important, and he has a full-blown political agenda in that book. He says you got to throw the liberals out of the White House, you've got to rebuild the American military, you've got to break the back of the Council of Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission. He had what became a kind of early agenda of what emerged as the new Christian right. And that was something new for dispensationalists. You know, it's easy to find in the early days of American dispensationalism teachers who said, given the course of the present world and the fact that we know where history is going and we're in decline and things are going to get worse and worse and worse and not better, then Christians have no business being involved in politics. But by 1980, you have that tradition all of a sudden becoming politically involved. So it really is an amazing turnaround.
I remember Lindsay's book at the height of its popularity, and there was one point where it appeared that Lindsay was ready to, well, I don't think he ever did really set a date, but he was pretty sure that about 1984 or thereabouts, it was all going to come to a head and there would be the secret rapture. Well, now we are 24, almost 25 years past that point. Surely there were some dispensationalists after the failure of that expectation of Lindsay who were saying, why are we still here? Why haven't we been raptured?
Well, you would think so. You know, in American history in the 1840s, there was a movement called the Millerites who had predicted precisely the second coming on October 22nd, 1844. And, you know, they gathered together, they met during that night, waiting for the end of the world to come, and it didn't come, and that was a hard pill to swallow. What Lindsay did in his book was to say that, you know, based on all of it, the Olivet Discourse in Matthew 24, Jesus said, this generation will not pass away till all these things come to pass. And he argued that a generation in the Bible is 40 years, and that the starting point for this generation would be the founding of the State of Israel in 1948. So 40 plus 4, 1948 is 88. But he, if you read that passage, he, you know, there were all kinds of qualifiers. You know, if we are correct in our calculations and so on. So he didn't, you know, not too many people became too excited in 88 when that didn't happen. Although there was another very popular author at that time, his star rose quickly and then declined. His name was Weizenacht. He was an engineer who came out with a little book called 88 Reasons Why Jesus is Coming in 1988. And that little booklet just set fires all over the country. And you know, this got a lot of people excited, but that didn't stop it. You know, it just, 88 came and went, and there were people arguing, you know, making a case for the year 2000 or thereabouts. Dispensationalism is not supposed to do that. They say that the prophetic clock has been stopped until the rapture, so there's no way to really calculate any of these things. But that doesn't keep the Bible teachers now and then from taking a whack at it.
We're talking with Dr. Timothy Weber, president of Memphis Theological Seminary, author of the new book, On the Road to Armageddon, How Evangelicals Became Israel's Best Friend. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues, Etc. We're talking about American evangelical support for Israel. In about 3 minutes that we have before we go to our first break, Dr. Weber, would you explain what Zionism is and the relationship between Zionism and dispensationalism?
Well, Zionism as a political movement got going at the end of the last century. It was an attempt to, at first it was a Jewish attempt to bring about the founding of a new Jewish homeland. And Theodor Herzl was the prime mover at that time. And as I said, that was mainly a movement of Jews following some times of terrible persecution and anti-Semitism in Europe in the 1880s. And Zionism played a very important role in the founding of Israel. It helped to to spur the British on to the Balfour Declaration in 1917, which promised that after World War I that the British government would be in favor of founding a Jewish homeland in Palestine. And Zionism was the political arm that really gave the push toward the founding of the State of Israel in 1948.
And Zionism in its present form appears to now have migrated into Christianity through the door of dispensationalism, it appears. The same considerations that were at work in the early 20th century in Western Europe.
Yes, that's right. And it's interesting that early dispensationalists, of course, got very excited when they heard about Zionism. They traced it, they kept track of it, they reported on it. Although, again, very few got down on the field and did anything about it. There were a few exceptions. There was one American named William Blackstone who actually petitioned U.S. presidents to help found a state of Israel starting in the 1890s. But he was the exception and not the rule. But you're right. After, by mid-century in the 20th century, a lot of dispensationalists had become Christian Zionists, and it supported the founding of the State of Israel and its survival.
Well, very briefly, with only 30 seconds here, with the Balfour Declaration and mm-hmm. the founding of the modern State of Israel, was it pretty much smooth sailing for the dispensationalists? Did they see all the pieces fall into place exactly as they thought they might with the founding of Israel?
No. It took a lot longer and was much more difficult. Many dispensationalists believed that when the British government issued the Balfour Declaration that a Jewish state was going to be formed within months. But it took 30 years. And there were all kinds of ups and downs, and the British kept supporting and reneging on their promises. And there was a time when it looked like a Jewish state was just not going to happen. So it wasn't smooth sailing after Balfour. There were lots of ups and downs. But most dispensationalists said, well, sooner or later it's going to happen. It's not evidently happening as easily as we thought, but given enough time, there will be a nation.
When we come back from this break, we're going to continue our conversation for the last 25 minutes of Issues Etc. with Dr. Timothy Weber, author of the new book, On the Road to Armageddon, How Evangelicals Became Israel's Best Friend. Sometimes I wonder if you were to walk into, say, the average evangelical church where dispensational preaching holds sway Sunday after Sunday, you would be able to get a pretty clear answer from someone sitting there on that Sunday morning of why they are pro-Israel. However, there's also another sector of American evangelicalism that is pro-Israel, and they can't give you a real solid reason. They just think, you know, aren't Christians supposed to be pro-Israel, and doesn't Israel have something to do, the modern state of Israel, have something to do with biblical prophecy? And after all, they kind of do a little bit of Pascal's wager here. I'd hate to be on the wrong side and not support Israel, so I'm going to support Israel. It's the safest position for me to take. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about the dark side of dispensationalism and things like the influence of the Left Behind series and whether or not dispensationalists give Israel a pass in its conflict with the Palestinians. We'll be right back.
A voice in the wilderness of American evangelicalism. You're listening to Issues Etc.
While the Reformation was primarily a theological movement, a return to the centrality of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Reformation was also a cultural movement. Among other things, it signaled the beginning of democracy, the birth of the modern German language, and the Reformation triggered cultural conflict for almost a century afterward. If you'd like to study the Reformation in greater detail, you need our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for October, The Renaissance and Reformation Movements. The two-volume set is $40.99. Each book is $23.99. Go to our Issues Etc. website and browse before you buy, issuesetc.org. Look under the What's New section or call to order the books from Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040. 1-800-325-3040. When you call, mention Issues Etc. issuesetc.org.
Satan, now when did he fall?
Answers with Ken Ham
author of the best-selling book, The Lie Evolution. Well, Ken, you've got an intriguing question today. Does the Bible give us any hint about when Satan may have rebelled?
Well, the Bible is really all about man and his relationship with his Creator. For that reason, the Bible doesn't give us a lot of details about the angelic realm, and it doesn't explicitly tell us when Satan rebelled. Now, some Christians, in their effort to add millions of years to the Bible, believe what is called the gap theory. They propose a gap of millions of years between the first two verses of Genesis, and in this gap they say, well, that's where Satan rebelled. But you know, the Bible tells us that everything God created, and this includes all principalities and all powers, everything was very good. Thus there could be no rebellion, no sin, no death when God finished the creation week. This means that Satan, or any of the angels for that matter, couldn't have rebelled before this time. Now, because God blessed the seventh day of the creation week and sanctified it, it makes biblical sense to put the fall of Satan after the creation week. This is just another reason why compromise positions like the gap theory don't fit with Scripture.
This question of the length of the creation days remains a controversial one in Christian circles. Well, Ken Ham is not one to shy away from controversy, and he explores this topic in a free booklet available on our website, AnswersRadio.com.
This is Dr. John Tape with the Media Minute. Some TV networks will try anything to gain more viewers. With more viewers, the networks can charge advertisers more money to run commercials. That's how TV networks stay in business, by selling time for commercials. The traditional formula has been to increase ratings by adding more sex and violence to the programs. However, a new study in the Journal of Applied Psychology reveals that when a TV program has much sex and violence, viewers are less likely to remember the commercials. As Christian parents, remind your children that Jesus died to give us a new life, one that abhors violence and sexual immorality. Because of Jesus, we don't want violence and immorality in our lives, and these studies show that advertisers don't need these on the screen. This Media Minute is brought to you by the Christian Media Literacy Institute. Please visit our website at cmli.org.
Do you want more of God's grace? Bethany Lutheran Church in Fairview Heights is a Bible-believing church, faithful to the Scriptures, a place for the whole family, a community gathered around Christ that cares, with a vibrant historic Christian liturgy. Bethany Lutheran Church is located at 5600 Old Collinsville Road in Fairview Heights. Visit them at www.bethanylcms.org.
The holy city of Jerusalem is our spiritual capital, and the continuation of Jewish sovereignty over the Holy Land is a further bulwark to us that the God of the Bible exists and that His Word is true.
There again is Pat Robertson speaking at a recent pilgrimage of evangelicals to Israel. We're talking about the history behind American evangelical support for the modern state of Israel with Dr. Timothy Weber, president of Memphis Theological Seminary, author of the new book, On the Road to Armageddon, How Evangelicals Became Israel's Best Friend. Dr. Weber, you write about the dark side of dispensationalism. How would you characterize this?
By the dark side, I mean the rather ambivalent view that many dispensationalists have about Jews. On the one hand, dispensationalists are uncompromising in their support of Israel as the ground zero for the end times, and therefore they will support the state of Israel against all of its enemies and see that as a Christian duty. But at the same time, historically, dispensationalists have not been too sure about the Jews who live down the street. And from time to time in their history, they have become rather susceptible to anti-Semitic arguments themselves. And even during the 1930s, often sounded a bit like Nazis in some of the critiques that they had of Jews in their own time.
In the modern time, would thoroughgoing dispensationalists consider it a Christian duty to support Israel, even if they have, from time to time, moral qualms about how Israel is conducting itself, say, in the conflict with the Palestinians? I mean, what they would find in any other country to be either unjust or oppressive or going over the top. When it comes to Israel, they say, well, you know, that's God's chosen people. There we go.
Well, I think that that is pretty much the case. There are occasionally dispensational leaders who will raise the ethical question concerning ends and means. But for the most part, dispensationalists have been rather consistent in saying that that Israel is reaping the benefits of divine promise, that they are where they ought to be, that in fact God has promised them not only their current land and occupied territory, but from the Nile to the Euphrates. This goes back to Genesis. And therefore, when Israel expands, they are simply experiencing the blessing and promise of God. Therefore, it is absolutely wrong to pressure Israel to give up the land that God has promised them. That goes against the very plan of God. So it is safe to say that in general, dispensationalists will support Israel regardless.
What do they do when they see, say, the roadmap for peace derailed and suddenly the prime minister of Israel is talking about giving Gaza part of the traditional boundaries, giving Gaza to the Palestinians, or even President George W. Bush consistently supporting the establishment of a Palestinian state?
They're against it. And they will use political lobbying and pressure in order to keep it from happening.
Let's say for the sake of argument, I'm asking you to speculate, not act as a historian, but perhaps a bit as a prognosticator. Mm. Knowing what you know of dispensationalists, their ability, as you put it before, to either deny or to tweak or to adjust their system in the face of unforeseen events, if in the next 10 years, say, there were a genuine Palestinian state capitaled in East Jerusalem, that is established with boundaries, with borders joining that of Israel, and Israel were coexisting in that land with a Palestinian state, how do you think the dispensationalists would adjust their system to accommodate?
Well, I'm guessing. I think what they would say is it's temporary. It won't last. Or they might say, this is not, in fact, the Israel of prophecy. Before Israel became a state, there was a lively debate within dispensational circles whether Zionism was actually a fulfillment of Bible prophecy or not. A lot of dispensationalists had a real problem with Zionism because it tended to be socialistic in its politics and secular in its religion. And they said, you know, when we see the restoration of the Jews in Palestine, it's in belief. It's not in unbelief. And therefore, in some cases, up until the day that independence was declared, you had some dispensationalists who argued that even if Israel is founded by Zionists, it's not necessarily going to be the Israel of Bible prophecy.
Do you think the average dispensationalist sitting in an evangelical church is aware of the fact that there were dispensationalists arguing against the modern state of Israel being the fulfillment of Bible prophecy?
No, obviously not. When there actually was a state established, the people who had raised questions about it dropped the questions. You know, after the founding of the state of Israel, you don't find dispensationalists arguing about that anymore. Now, another interesting question to contemplate is, what if all the Arabs got together and, God forbid, Israel was shoved into the sea, was annihilated? What would the prophecy teachers say then? Well, I don't know what else they could say other than that wasn't the real Israel.
That was a precursor or a
It was a warm-up. The real Israel is coming. And they might go back to what had been kind of the original position, and that is that restoration comes about just before the coming of Jesus Christ or in connection with it, and it will be done in belief. One of the things that a lot of Jews consider to be the dark side, getting back to this dark side issue again, is that at the same time that dispensationalists support Israel without compromise, they also were very eager to convert Jews to Christ. And, of course, this doesn't sit well with a lot of Jews. They say, how can you have it both ways? How can you support us and then try to make us Christians at the same time? And dispensationalists have never seen any contradiction to this, because they have argued that when Jesus comes, the Jews who remain alive at his coming will accept him as their Messiah, and therefore all Israel will be saved. And so this really ticks off a lot of Jews who say, you know, here we have these supporters of the state of Israel who are arguing ultimately that Judaism will pass away and all Jews will become Christians. So that doesn't go well with them. At the same time, a lot of Jews say, well, we don't care about that. We need the support now, and we'll take it where we can get it.
Dr. Weber, I'd like your reaction to a recent warning issued by to President Bush by the Reverend Pat Robertson. Here it is.
If he touches Jerusalem and really gets serious about taking East Jerusalem and making it the capital of a Palestinian state, he'll lose virtually all evangelical support.
What's your response to this?
Well, I think it just underscores what we've already said, that dispensationalists believe that Israel is there by divine appointment, and that there is a plan. It is outlined in the Bible. It is, and anybody who steps into that plan to try to stop it or change it is going against God. And them's fighting words as far as dispensationalists are concerned. I think they would stop supporting Bush or any American president who would put pressure on Israel or undertake American power to take away Israeli land.
So why are they still supporting Bush if he's made it very clear over the last 4 years of his presidency, if he hasn't made any progress in this respect, regardless, that he does want to see a Palestinian state?
Well, there are probably a lot of answers to that question. One may be that it beats the alternative. You know, Bush still beats the alternative. Or dispensationalists may argue that Bush says one thing, but he never does anything about it.
Well, I've noticed something, and maybe it's a coincidence, and maybe there's a real affinity here. And that is between the dispensational worldview and scheme of reading the Bible and conspiracy theories in general.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a real affinity here? Is it just a coincidence that the two seem to be found so often together?
Well, you know, one person has argued that dispensationalism is the ultimate cosmic conspiracy theory. Dispensationalism has been, from time to time, rather susceptible to conspiracy theories. Back in the early 20th century, in the 20s and 30s, for example, dispensationalists I can't say without exception, but it was very popular to look at the protocols of the Elders of Zion, for example, which purportedly was the minutes of a secret group of Jewish bankers and politicians and other leaders to conquer the world and to destroy Christianity. And this, the protocols came out as it was kind of standard anti-Semitic argument. And anti-Semites, you know, in this country and in Europe used the protocols for a few decades. And there was a time when dispensationalist Bible teachers read the protocols and said, see, this is exactly what we had been predicting, a decline of civilization, a satanic conspiracy to destroy Christian civilization and the church and so on. And so anything that kind of fit the system, they had a tendency to grab onto. By the mid-30s and late-30s, there were a lot of dispensationalists who said, you know, this was really a stupid idea, and we need to disavow any arguments that include the protocol. So there was kind of a backlash against that conspiracy theory. But I think there is a certain tendency to see forces, dark forces at work, and to and to blame problems on conspiracies, satanic and otherwise.
I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. Now, if you have a question or a comment on evangelical support for Israel, give us a call now. We've got about 10 minutes left in this conversation with Dr. Timothy Weber, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Dr. Weber is president of Memphis Theological Seminary and author of the book On the Road to Armageddon, How Evangelicals Became Israel's Best Friend, 505-7850. 1-800-730-2727. Now, you mentioned this before in connection to Pat Robertson. The New World Order, when did this wrinkle in dispensational, it's now kind of boilerplate stuff in dispensational writings, when did this enter into dispensational thinking?
Well, in one form or another, it's been around almost from the beginning. You can find some of the early 19th century dispensationalist teachers talk about the coming New World Order, which they had a tendency to define in terms of an apostate religion, especially an apostate Christianity that in the early days was a tendency to say the Pope would be in charge of this great worldwide Christian apostasy. Hal Lindsey saw it as a combination of Eastern religions and Christian apostates and so on. But New World Order idea has been around in one form or another for a long time, but it really came into its own with the fall of the Soviet Empire in about 1990.
So, as you mentioned before, it became a stand-in for the Soviet Union.
That's right.
After the Soviet Union ceased to exist.
It became the next big thing.
505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Going to the phones, Barbara is calling from St. Louis. Barbara, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you. I have a friend who says the Bible tells us that those who bless Israel, God will bless. Those who curse Israel, God will curse. Therefore, if the United States does not support Israel, the United States will be cursed by God. Would you please comment on that?
Thank you, Barbara. Is this typical of kind of the rhetoric of dispensationalists nowadays?
Yes, absolutely. You know, that comes from Genesis. I think it's Genesis chapter 12, or maybe it's 19. I can't remember offhand. But that verse is cited by Pat Robertson and Jerry Falwell and all kinds of dispensationalist leaders in order to remind all American Christians that there is ultimately a lot at stake in whether we support Israel or not. But that's the biblical argument that is very commonly heard these days.
Now, Barbara, I would just add to Dr. Weber's comments there that a proper reading of that promise to Abraham is fulfilled in Jesus Christ, that the blessing that comes upon Abraham, his descendants, and all the world comes ultimately through his seed, through the descendant, Jesus Christ, as the Savior of all, both the descendants of Abraham and everyone else as well. Through you, all the nations of the world will be blessed, a promise pertaining to Jesus Christ. What is the role of Islam, and in particular militant Islam, in the last 20 years or so in the dispensationalist mindset?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, here is another issue which dispensationalists paid almost no attention to until the early 90s and the first Gulf War. Before that, Islam was seen as one of the participants of that last great attempt to destroy Israel. Islam was noted as being part of the kings of the south in Bible prophecy, which referred to probably an Egyptian an African and Arab alliance that would attack Israel from the south. The Soviet Union and its allies would attack from the north. That would bring in the kings of the east, the Red Chinese, according to more recent arguments and so on. But Islam wasn't really seen as a major factor. Well, this Islam has obviously become much more central in dispensationalist concern since 1990 and early 90s, and certainly since 2001 and 9/11.
What's the role of the popular Left Behind series, authored by Jerry Jenkins and Tim LaHaye? You mentioned before The Late Great Planet Earth and the subsequent books by Hal Lindsey.
Yes.
Here is a series of fiction spanning over 12 volumes that has sold like hotcakes.
That's right. They're the new leaders in total book sales. They have blown right past Hal Lindsey, over 50 million copies all told, and still rising. Late Great Planet Earth is an attempt to take pretty much Lindsey's perspective and modern dispensationalist ideas and putting it into a fictionalized form. It has reached all kinds of people, even beyond the kind of dispensational subculture. You hear all kinds of folks who had never even heard of dispensationalism before, who have become avid readers of the series. I would say that the Left Behind series is probably at present the most effective disseminator of dispensationalist ideas around. It has been enormously effective. You know, there's an historian from the University of Wisconsin called Paul Boyer, and he wrote a book called When Time Shall Be No More, and he argues in that book that even though dispensationalists themselves occupy a rather small core of devotees, maybe, I don't know, 12, 15 million, their influence goes way beyond their own group. You know, if you can kind of think of a series of concentric circles, you've got dispensationalists in the middle. They read the Bible. They can give you chapter and verse. They can give you the scenario, the step-by-step outline of what's going to happen. They're really into it. But outside that dispensationalist core, there's another group of people, most of them Christian. Hello?
Hello. We're still here, yes.
Who very much believe that the Bible teaches about the future, but they're not quite sure what it teaches. They know it's there somewhere, and therefore they will during times of crisis they will listen to those Bible teachers. Beyond that group is another group, many millions more, who don't pay the Bible much mind at all, but during times of real crisis and fear, they're willing to give a listen to the people who say they know what's happening and what's going to happen next. So Boyer argues that even though dispensationalism really occupies only about a third of the whole evangelical movement in America, its influence goes way beyond it. And I think Left Behind series is probably the primary reason that's so these days.
Two quick questions here as we close up. Do you think that those in that outer circle who have been influenced by the Left Behind series but are not the devotees, do you think there's often kind of that Pascal's wager taking place their way? Say, look, if they're right, I don't want to be on the wrong side of history, so if I'm going to support Israel, whether or not I really buy into the whole dispensational scheme.
I think so, certainly. I think that, you know, one does not have to be a dispensationalist. You pointed this out earlier, to support Israel. Christian people who read the Bible and who read a lot about Israel and then read about Israel in the paper, it's very easy for people to make that connection. And so there's a kind of natural bent towards supporting Jews in their time of need. By Bible readers, I think that's a very natural thing, and dispensationalism takes that and makes the most of it.
With 2 minutes before we have to wrap up our conversation, Dr. Weber, after 30-plus years of friendship between American evangelicals and the modern state of Israel, what has that friendship produced?
Well, I think it's produced an enormously effective and powerful lobby in the United States of American Christians, most of whom are dispensationalists, but not all of whom are dispensationalists, who feel that it really is their Christian duty to support Israel against all of its enemies. And this has taken, no American president can ignore this group. No diplomat can ignore this group.
Is there a downside to this 30-year friendship, in your estimation?
Well, of course, it raises all kinds of important ethical questions. You know, do the ends ever justify the means? I think that, you know, one of the most interesting downsides of this, and we don't have time to really talk about it, but I'll just throw it out. And it's ironic to me, it's very curious, that in all of the concern of American Christians, American evangelical Christians in particular, toward Israel, that what they have turned a blind eye to is the thousands upon thousands of Palestinian Christians who just don't make it on their radar screen.
It's a very good point to end on. Dr. Timothy Weber, thank you very much for being our guest.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dr. Timothy Weber, president of Memphis Theological Seminary and author of the new book, On the Road to Armageddon, How Evangelicals Became Israel's Best Friend. You have to marvel at a system as new and as young as dispensationalism in the scope of Christian history that is as flexible as this one is, does not stand on principle over time, really, because if the headlines change, then your system may change. If the course of history moves in a direction you didn't expect according to your dispensationalist scheme, well, then maybe it may even come to the point where the modern state of Israel wasn't the fulfillment of biblical prophecy. After all, you're looking ahead to something else. It's flexible. You got to give it that. One must stand in awe of its flexibility, although flexibility is hardly a characteristic of the truth, I would argue. What do we make of all these references in prophecy to Israel? What do we make of these things? Well, Scripture presents the center of Holy Scripture as not Israel, but Israel reduced to one, Jesus, the descendant of Abraham, come to fulfill what God had always promised his descendant would do, and that is to bring blessing, the blessing of forgiveness of sins and life and salvation, not only to God's people of the Old Testament through faith in him, but to us too, to all nations. Through him, all the nations of the world are blessed. Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., David Mills of Touchstone Magazine joins us to talk about politicians imposing their values. Dr. Martin Noland of the Concordia Historical Institute will join us here in Studio A to talk about Martin Luther's evangelical thrust, and then we'll also talk about the 60 Minutes feature on stay-at-home moms with Suzanne Venker, author of the book Seven Myths of Working Mothers. That's tomorrow on Issues, Etc. I urge you, if you didn't get a chance to hear our second hour, in the next couple of days, go to the KFUO website, kfuo.org, click on that second hour, dated today, Wednesday, October 13th, hour two of Issues, Etc. Click on it and listen to the entire thing. Really. Especially after tonight's debate and in the next couple of weeks. Listen to this on the question of whether or not George W. Bush is a social and political conservative but a theological liberal. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues, Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues, Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.